This is Holidays Unbound, Episode 4, The Passover Seder. Welcome back, everyone. I'm Dan Liebenson, and I'm here with my co-host Ruth Abish-Magder, and we're really excited to jump with both feet into the subject that we've all been waiting for, the Passover Seder. So, Ruth, it's great to be with you.
Great to be here.
Yeah, we finally arrived at the Seder, which I think is sort of telling in terms of what we're trying to do with this series, right, is that I think people often get to the Seder, and boom, there they are. And I think that the one thing that I've been thinking about the Seder is, like, the more preparation in advance, the better the actual experience of the Seder. So hopefully we're exemplifying that here by only getting to the Seder on the late side in our series.
Well, I think that we've given ourselves some time to prepare for getting to this episode as well, because it took us a little while to get warmed up. So I'm feeling excited about the Seder. I'm hosting this year for the first time. I've only done it once before, first time in a long time, and my entire extended family is coming. So it's going to be a big challenge, and I'm glad to have some perspective and some ideas from other people to help me feel prepared and ready.
My experience changes every year. This year, for various family-related reasons, actually, my family is going to be split up during Passover. My son and I are going to be in one place, and my wife and daughter are going to be in another place, and so it's a little discombobulating. I don't know. It's going to be different from previous years, so we'll see how we resolve all that, but maybe we'll be able to gather some interesting data and bring it back for next year's Seder.
Well, let us know what you end up doing.
Yeah. So in our thinking about how to really take a crack at this question of the Seder, we wanted to share another little snippet of our conversation with Abigail Pogrebin, the author of the recent book, My Jewish Year, 18 Holidays, One Wandering Jew. We've been talking to her about Passover and interspersing this conversation throughout the episodes on Passover. And we started by asking Abigail to reflect on how she thinks about creativity and the Seder.
I'm a huge believer in creativity without it being shtick, that the creativity is driven by the learning, by the underpinnings of the holiday itself. So I would say Passover for me is the gold standard for creativity because there are so many opportunities to bring it to life. I am also very aware of mostly requiring everyone at the table to play a part. Not requiring, but asking, because otherwise it becomes an entirely passive experience. And I don't actually believe when people read the Haggadah, they are kind of really engaging with the words that they're reading, unless you take a step back or come at it a little bit differently, a little more actively.
The thing that I've been thinking about Passover these days is that basically we're doing it all wrong. I mean, I don't know if this is true or not, but in my sense and in my experience, this idea that we pass a book around the table and read from it doesn't feel right. I've been thinking about it lately as if you invited people over for a dinner party, and instead of serving them food, you just passed around a cookbook and sat around the table reading a cookbook. You know, that's not what a cookbook is for. A cookbook is meant to be used before the meal by the person who's getting the meal ready, and then what the people need to do is actually eat the meal. So what I think is that basically somehow the Haggadah is really there for the Seder leader to read and reflect on and think about how to construct the experience for everybody else. But fundamentally, the experience is meant to be an experience, not a sitting around the table reading. And that ultimately, it's supposed to be a reenactment. It's supposed to be the idea that each and every one of us, by the end of this experience, feels like we actually were freed slaves from Egypt. That's at least my basic understanding of what the Talmudic requirement is for Passover, right? That each and every one of us actually feels, not remembers, not has empathy for others, but that we actually feel that we ourselves were slaves that were freed. And then the question is, what follows from that?
Well, and I would actually say, to continue your metaphor, it should be people sitting around the table cooking the meal. That is what I hope happens. And then we eat it together. You know, they say that Passover, the Seder, is supposed to be a reenactment. I have so much trouble with that idea. How realistic is that to reenact the Exodus? All of us in our nice clothes sitting around the table about to eat gefilte fish. It just isn't real. And I don't attempt that. But what I do think is that there has to be kind of greater elbow grease that goes into every step of the Seder. And there are, you know, however many, you know, phases you do, maybe people don't do them all. Make sure that those things are landing in a place where people can really understand them and talk about them and frankly remember them. The Maxwell House Haggadah, which has the Maxwell House ads in it, all of our lives or whatever Haggadah we grew up with, it is not some fixed, codified, blessed thing. It was meant to be constantly reinterpreted and changed. The point is to tell the story. There are certain obligations and we meet them, but the Haggadah is fluid. And what, you know, there are not a lot of things in Judaism you can say that about. So what an opportunity that is.
So as we wanted to dive a little bit deeper into the question of the Haggadah's role in the Seder and what it could be, what it has been, what it should be, we decided to talk to Professor Vanessa Oakes. She is the author of Inventing Jewish Ritual and was a guest on Judaism Unbound in one of our first episodes. We wanted to talk to her about a project that she's working on now, which is a biography of the Haggadah. So it really seems like that would be a great place to start. So we asked Professor Oakes to reflect a little bit about the Haggadah and its role in the Seder in general and then in America in particular.
In the earliest days of marking Passover at a symposium-type meal, a Greco-Roman symposium-type meal, essentially people ate a meal together and they studied the laws of Passover together. They told the story of Passover, and you didn't need to put it in a book because it was a story that everybody knew. It was an intimate, familiar story. What I discovered in working on this book is what my gut had told me long ago, which is there's a reason that the Haggadah has been rewritten and recreated and reprinted and republished and revised so many times. And that's because it doesn't quite work. I don't know that it ever worked for anybody ever since it was written down. It is a ritual text which compensates for the fact that we're no longer doing the ritual that Jews once did on Passover. We're no longer going to the ancient temple in Jerusalem with our lamb that we're going to sacrifice, with our families, with our bedrolls, with our extra foods. We're no longer gathering with a nation. We're no longer feeling incredible grandeur. We're no longer worshiping God together in the same place. So we're sitting in our own houses with a book that tells us that our table is like an altar in the ancient temple, and that our family is like all of the Jewish people. And the shank bone, which in our house is a beet, is like a slaughtered lamb. Well, so much is like so much else that you're pretty sure that it's not the same thing. Everything is pointing to something else. And the liturgy that we have now has been gathered over so many years, and much of it hasn't been let go, things that should have been let go, that we're stuck with an enormous text if we feel compelled that we need to be saying every single word. But we've got a lot of baggage with us in this text, and essentially it cries out, make selections. Use this text more wisely. Don't follow it verbatim. And I think that the text has been recreated so many times because leaders and artists and liturgists have recognized that most Jews don't feel the sense of ownership and autonomy to be able to take the text and say, what's workable for me? The ritual, ideally, would have us experience why this night is different, why we need renewal, why we need to remember slavery, why we need to project into the future or to imagine our future visions and work toward them.
So the most famous Haggadah in the United States is the Maxwell House Haggadah. How did it come to be that we have a coffee-based Haggadah?
that began as a promotion for coffee. In days gone by, there were those Jews who were anxious that coffee beans were not permitted for Passover. Of course they are, and the Maxwell House Company wanted to persuade folks through their advertisements that that you could have coffee, and they began.
You mean that it was kosher for Passover?
That it was kosher for Passover, and the Haggadah that they first created promoted this fact. And over the years, there would be pictures of people drinking Maxwell House coffee, and it was called the traditional Passover coffee. And it was free. People would buy their matzahs at the grocery store, and there are these stacks of free Haggadahs. And it solved the problem of how would you have enough texts for all of your family without having to make an investment. And it looked and seemed like it was, if it was authentic, as if it were the real thing. It didn't look like it was an advertisement that much. I mean, people could, in the way that we don't really notice commercials so much when we watch TVs, people could sort of ignore the Maxwell House advertising. And over the years, even the advertising began to feel a little bit intimate to people. At the first White House Seder, From what I've heard, the planners were it was suggested to the planners that they use all forms of new Haggadot, and they decided to go ahead with the quote unquote traditional Haggadah, and they did use a Maxwell House. I don't know what they use now, but it was originally the Maxwell House.
In our conversation with Vanessa, I asked her where she's really seeing some interesting innovations with the Seder. And she suggested that Rabbi Amichai Lau Lavi in New York, who we've also had in the past as a guest on Judaism Unbound, that he had put together something called the Seder, S-A-Y-D-E-R, that she was especially impressed with. So we decided to track down Amichai again and ask him some questions about the Seder and find out how he's thinking about what the Seder, S-E-D-E-R, can be at its best.
So the Seder, S-A-Y-D-E-R, started off as an alternative to a second Seder that I was leading in a house in Manhattan about a decade ago, full of about 50, 60 folks in their 20s, 30s, either lapsed Jews or in mixed marriages, etc., who came together but did not really want to engage in the full-on cover-to-cover Haggadah. So what I improvised on the spot pretty much was a condensed version that had four questions, each one dealing with a major theme of what Passover night is about and inviting real conversation. So the first question pretty much, and this got tweaked over the years, but pretty much was Mani Shtana, what's new? Who are you? What's different? Introduce yourself to each other, to ourselves, with a sense of what's new in my world. And we then tweaked it to either what's new in my world since this time last year or what type of change do I want to see in the world. So that was just like an intro. I could go around and then we introduced the four cups. So it was the first toast. It was very light, but with oomph. And some of the other Passover food tropes began to be introduced. The Kadesh with some kind of the kalpas, etc., appetizers. Then the second round was we went into the story, basically. Condensed the story into two paragraphs, basically, the Cliff Note version. And say, okay, you know the story of the Exodus. What is this about? What is the metaphor? Where is slavery today in the world? What does it feel to you like, the metaphor of enslavement? Now, this coming year, sidebar, very different than last year, right? Whoa, we are living the Exodus narrative in ways that who knows how it's going to play out. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely resonance, which was not the case last year. It was very personal when people would talk about sugar or technology or human trafficking or capitalism or fear. etc. So it was this conversation in which we're in split screen. Here's the text. Here's the metaphor. Bechol dor v'dor, in every generation, one must see oneself as though one left Egypt. It is a human invitation for conversation for symposium. So that's the second question. And then food comes in at some point, and the second cup, etc. And then the third question is Dayenu. What if we had to stop, or we could stop, the source of oppression and enslavement? What would it look like? What could you do? What could we do to stop, to say, okay, go, release, solve? So that's an interesting conversation. And then the fourth is Lashana Haba, next year in Jerusalem. What would it look like if we had brand new grand visions for the freer, happier world we want? So come on, toast for next year. That's it. Now, in between, we might throw in Dayenu or other songs. There are some poems or anecdotes. There's a lot of add-ons. But basically, let's meet for a dinner party, talk about that story, and talk about how it applies to our lives. Whether we are Jews or not, pious or not, informed, literate or not, it's a simple grid. So this was started off on the fly. Into the second question, we realized that somebody was texting the question to her cousin in Long Island, who was at like a typical cover-to-cover Seder, was dying. And she started asking those questions at that Seder. And then someone else started texting. So by the end of the night, it turned out that not only were we in the room, about 50 of us engaged in this conversation, about 10 other living rooms were engaged in these conversations because people were texting them or whatever to other people. So we thought that was great. But the next year, we developed it a little further, and then we did it into Hebrew. And now it exists as an option, whether it's an alternative first or second Seder, or whether it's something that you add on, a question or two or three. I've led in the last years quite a few Seders that were either based entirely on this four-question format or introduced them into longer Seders. And I will say, with every year that goes by, I have absolutely less and less patience and respect for the Haggadah text as we now have it. It was never meant to be read cover to cover. It was always meant to be seen as an anthology where one picks and chooses the pieces that work best based on who the audience is, what is the age range, etc. And the enslavement of the Maxwell House cover to cover is a sign of great illiteracy and attachment to formats that do not serve us well. It was created in a relatively literate context. And if you read the Haggadah closely, you can see that it really is Midrash. So the Jewish oral tradition is developed by the rabbis in the Greco-Roman context, including the way people sat down. It was a symposium. It was a Roman style symposium on questions of liberty and freedom and history and memory. And that's powerful. That format is powerful, which is why in my attempts, I retain a lot of the format, a lot of the idioms, some of the questions, some of the stories and quotes from the original context. But I think the way it was formulated is not user-friendly for your average user. And the reason people have been reading it cover to cover, which, by the way, is only a 500-year-old phenomena. Printing gave us that. Look, the deal is the original Seder, the original text and ritual come from a very specific socio-normative reality of Roman times, sitting in a symposium, talking about philosophy, and it's a collection of thoughts. It doesn't even tell the story from beginning to end. It's certainly not very kid-friendly, despite the four children and the songs at the end. It is an evolution of a text that we know throughout the Middle Ages accumulated more and more ways to make it user-friendly. It's a bit too much for your average modern user. I don't think it tells a story. It doesn't invite the type of engagement that we need today. So the question is, what of the baby we keep? How much of the bathwater we refresh? And how do we balance? That's the question about everything in Jewish life. Certainly for something as hallowed as we have to read the Haggadah and it's got to be Uncle Bernie falling asleep and what's her name. It's like things are part of the Seder that have nothing to do with the original intention, that have to do with the beauty of preserving tradition. I will tell you that when the Hebrew version came out, I got into a 50-day 51-day fight with my brother. I know exactly because it was 2 days before the Seder, and we finished it 1 day before Shavuot. Like, basically, the entire Omer, we were not talking. Because he was furious that the opening line to my Hebrew version of the Seder was, what if the Seder was not the most boring introduction to dinner? And he said, why are you being so negative? And I said, because I hate the Seder. I hate sitting at our family Seder and reading through this whole damn text. I hate it. It bores me. And I'm a literate one, let alone everybody in my community. And he just thought I was being disrespectful to thousands of years worth of people struggling with this text. So, duly noted, I want to be respectful to the fact that there is a deal of intimacy and nostalgia and little bits of meaning that we cling to. But at the end of the day, I think the prize is more important than just keeping on to posterity as was. This is an important night. This is the big night that Jews gather around tables with people they know and love, Jewish or not, to have a conversation about continuity, about memory, about values, about freedom, about choice. To lose that opportunity because we're loyal to a text that was never meant to be read cover to cover, it is not a poem. It is not a play. If you told me we were going to sit around and read the Song of Songs and act it out erotically, okay, I'd argue with you. If you're saying let's read choice passages from Exodus, the book or the movie, I would listen. But the Haggadah was really never meant to be read cover to cover. It is an anthology. Imagine that you're hosting a dinner party and you want to serve chicken. And you serve the entire poultry section of your favorite cookbook to your miserable guests, right? There's no need for 35 versions of chicken at a dinner party. And I do not need every single rabbinic hoo-ha about the story of Exodus that does not speak to your average person today who wants to, who needs to, who yearns to make that story part of the marching orders of identity in this complicated reality. So in the battle of pick and choose, I want to pick the essence. I want to pick what the invitation of Passover is. I want to pluck some of the key terms, but open it up for what it was meant to be, a discourse and a true conversation about what matters most. Because here we are using the best in Jewish technology, retooled to matter to our modern lives.
Beyond the structure of the Seder itself and the Haggadah, we asked Vanessa Oakes, as a scholar of ritual innovation, where she was seeing some innovations in the Seder in Passover that were especially exciting to her in America these days.
What I find very exciting at this point is that the ritual practices that have been introduced in the last 20 years or so have now become very much part of the new traditional Haggadah. I love the fact that it's assumed in many family Haggadot, and not just women's Haggadot or feminist Haggadot. I love the fact that there's a ritual for Miriam's cup. Miriam's cup is truly powerful. It's still powerful for girls and women. I'm shocked that the orange is still there, but it is still there.
Why does that surprise you?
It surprises me because it was a sight gag. It pointed to a story that never happened of the bad rabbi who said that women belong on the bima as much as an orange does on the Seder plate, which did not happen. It hides the real story of gay women at Oberlin. It hides the real story of Susanna Heschel. As I recall this story, and it's been retold so many times, and I've even told it so many times that I may have some of the facts wrong, but as I recall this story, women at Oberlin heard a story from a Chabad Rebbetzin about lesbians not really belonging in Judaism. And these women had this idea that they would create a Passover ritual in which they put bread on the Seder plate. as if to say, you think we don't belong? You know, here's bread on this Seder plate, a way of sort of a backward way of saying we do belong. In some ways, a visual comment, not unlike the pink pussy hats that so many women were wearing at the March in Washington, and also the many marches supporting the March on Washington. Susanna Heschel, hearing about this, thought that the bread was really not the right gesture. It wasn't about something that was transgressive. And she came up with the idea of, initially, it was a tangerine, and you could spit out the seeds of misogyny. Later, as the story got out, we began to hear about a tale about a rabbi who, in the presence of Susanna Heschel, said that a woman belongs on a bima as much as an orange belongs on a Seder plate. And so that story got out. In fact, when people now put oranges on their plates, they are usually telling the story of the evil rabbi, who I believe is an urban legend. One of the problems with the ritual is, from the perspective of gay women, as it became a ritual which stood in for the presence of all women and the rights of gay women within Judaism, the respect for gay women within Judaism was covered over. It was usurped by being for all women. The reason I didn't think this ritual would last very long is it has an element of cuteness to it. And it's not certain to me exactly what does an orange point to anyway. If you look at Judaica stores, there are many Seder plates that have been created, commercially created, not just ones by individual fine artists, that you can buy a Passover plate with an orange on it. What the orange did, and what this is the part of the orange that I love, is that it opened the door for people to put new symbols on the Seder plate, an olive to address Palestinians, a tomato which might address those who are still enslaved, a piece of bread for the excluded, the orange for marginalized Jews of all types. Each year, new non-traditional images are showing up, and it's exciting each year to see the creativity that people are coming up with. I just remember, I believe this was back in 2011. People had used potato chips to indicate that there were many people in inner cities who weren't able to get fresh produce. There was once an artichoke, which reflected the thorny question of interfaith marriage. The olive reflected the quest for peace and so forth. I love that because it opens the possibility for Jews saying that our symbols didn't stop. They didn't stop in antiquity. They didn't stop in the Middle Ages. We're still creating symbols.
Well, I asked a bunch of people what their seders looked like, and one of the people who came back and answered me with something I thought was really interesting was Justin Goldstein, who's a friend of mine. He's the rabbi at Beth Israel Congregation in Asheville, and he's a really thoughtful guy. So we talked to him about the practical way he rethinks the seder, and we had a great conversation about how to make it all happen.
These alternative ways of doing, so-called alternative ways of doing a Passover seder is actually not outside the bounds of the tradition. It's reclaiming what the tradition once was. Before you had widespread publication of these books, there's no way that families hundreds of years ago were sitting around reading a book. We really focus heavily on the idea that the Passover Seder is a night of questions. So what we do is literally have a bowl on the table filled with questions. If we have guests, we tell them to bring a question with them written down. And we give no instructions as to what that question needs to be. So people are just invited to simply bring a question. And over the course of the night, we will reach into the bowl and pull out questions. And we also will, in one form or another, tell the story. But whether that story actually sounds like it's from the Torah is different. So we will tell a story that has to do with rebirth and renewal and liberation and the movement from oppression to liberation.
Tell me a little bit about how you decide what part of the story to tell.
The Haggadah was never actually meant to be a script. It's essentially a guide for if you don't know what the right questions to ask are or what the questions that will inspire a conversation about moving from servitude or oppression to liberation, then here's a guide for you. But you don't need that guide. You just need to be able to ask questions that inspire a story. My favorite time that we've done this is to play the game where one person starts a story and then you go around the table sharing a sentence, and so you have no control over where the story goes. And eventually, especially when it gets to a 5 or 6 year old mind, the story will go all sorts of other places. But to do it through asking questions, right, is ultimately where the Passover ritual has been grounded for many generations. We still follow the basic structure of what's presented in the Haggadah, and we still engage in the ritual activities. But what we're not doing is reading a book. So one of the other things that, you know, I take responsibility for is I'll steer the conversation in certain ways. And then in the lull of the conversation, it becomes time for someone to dip their hand into the bowl and pull out a question. And then a new conversation will start.
Vanessa Oakes also had a great story about a innovation at a Seder that she once attended.
We dared each other for each part of the Haggadah to do something new and interesting. And at one point, I think it was my actor nephew who decided we would leave the Seder table and he would fill up the bathtub in the guest bathroom and we would take off our shoes. And each one of us, one at a time, would wade through the bathtub in order to remember the part of the story where the Israelites crossed the sea. And there we were, eventually sitting back at the table with towels, drying our toes. And we were laughing, and it felt real.
We also talked to Amichai Lalevi about non-Haggadah restructuring ways in which he has played around with the Seder.
For the Magid part, the storytelling forte part, the grown-ups go into a conversation, the kids go off for about 25, 30 minutes to create a play or to tell the story or a part of the story in their own way. And we've got someone designated to work with them on that. Then they come back and show it. Meanwhile, the grown-ups get involved in a really important conversation that could be any type of reenactment. For instance, okay, let's split the room into two. It's one of my favorites. Half of you are Egyptians, half of you are Hebrews. We want to hear the story from both of your point of view. CNN, Fox, go. Okay, whoa. So every year that just becomes fascinating because we get to hear each other's stories as echoed. I focus on one question. There's this midrash that says that only 1 in 5 of the Hebrews left Egypt. 4 out of 5 preferred to have familiar slavery over unfamiliar freedom. Discuss. Where is this today? Rich conversation. We have these built-in tools. It's just like, look, the iPhone that I'm talking to you with right now, I know that I'm using about 2% of what this thing can do to make my life better. I never read through the user manual, and I never have patience or time to really activate it. I think it's the same with the Haggadah. We just use it, we read it. But you know what? That's a lazy option. And it doesn't pay us, it doesn't pay off in the long run.
But the metaphor that you use of the iPhone, I want to pursue that a little because I think it's really interesting in that most people who use an iPhone use it the way that you just described, right? They don't really know how to work it. They find an app that works for them and they use that. But there's millions of other apps that they have no idea about and they don't know, right? And the question becomes like, well, what if my apps stop working for me, you know, and I need to figure out how to use this better? What do I do? You're overwhelmed because there's so many apps and you certainly don't have the capacity to write your own app. because you never studied computer coding, you know, and I feel like that's in a way like the situation of the vast majority of Jews. I think that they have an instinct that there could be something really powerful here, but they don't know how to make it happen. And so
I totally agree.
Right, so your Seder is one of the, it's out there, you know, you go to the, download it, you know, but I wonder if there are other thoughts that you have about what people should do in the present, or maybe what we should try to bring about in the future that would really empower people to actually be able to have the kind of meaningful seders.
If you're going to be the host, because you've taken over from grandpa, then how are you going to work on this? You got to prepare this. You can't just sit there and wing it, right? An MC does homework. So let's prepare it. Let's have Passover boot camp. And by the way, the greatest rabbis do it. If you're literate or illiterate, you've got to do it. Every year I do it. I sit down and I say, okay, what is going to make a difference this year? What it could be, if it's good, is A, that feeling you get when you're at a really great dinner party. There are human connections. You're connecting to a bigger idea than yourself. You're part of something bigger. Human, historical, political, spiritual. Okay, I'm part of something. When I open that door to mystery, I open the door. I, you know, raise my fourth or eighth cup. I've gone through a transformation. Something happens that night. When I've asked questions and talked with people, we've just had a real conversation about one of the biggest issues for human beings. What is the extent of our freedom? I will just say also, I didn't say that one of the best things we've created for Seder is this Afikomen thing, where people, instead of just talking about justice and freedom, we actually collect money around the table, or IOUs, and whoever steals the hafikomen gets to choose which organization that really works for human freedom gets the money. And over the years, we've collected thousands of dollars at seders that whoever stole the matzah got to go to Human Rights Watch, the Trevor Project, NIF, JNF, you choose it. People chose. So it's a way of really walking our talk and not just talk, you know, just being abstract, but thinking out loud, how can we hands on this night do something real for others?
We also asked Abigail Pogrebin to reflect on what makes a great Seder, how she tries to make her Seder great after all the research that she's done over the course of writing her book.
I do think people are daunted by not being sure they know what to do. I completely sympathize with that. And I don't want to sound like I have all the answers at all. I have some suggestions that are road tested because I've tried them. And because, frankly, I don't want to be bored at my own Seder table. So that's really my bar that's guiding me. It's not so much like I want my kids to know exactly these facts, but I want them to look forward to the Seder itself and not just the meal. And that for sure has come to pass.
Interestingly, she also focuses on debates as one of the ways to make a Seder great.
One of the things that I do, because I believe that Judaism is about debate, and I think also kids especially like a good argument, is that I put under people's plates a position. So for instance, my nephew Ethan has the position that since Pharaoh's heart was hardened by God, the fact that he kept saying, you know, I won't let your people go, was not entirely his doing. In some way, it's not entirely his fault that he refused to free the Jews if his heart was hardened by another source. And my son, Ben, has under his plate, in a more condensed form, it is entirely Pharaoh's responsibility to free the Jews or not, and he should not be in any way exonerated because God hardened his heart. And they have 2 minutes, 1 minute each, to argue their point. So, you know, they did that at 13 years old. I'm not saying they're gifted kids. They were able to take that position thrown at them and kind of do their best. Similarly, Moses did not want to be the one to go and free the Jews. He actually balked when God told him to do it during the burning bush moment. I have one position being that that's actually the sign of a great leader, one who hesitates to lead. And someone else saying that's actually the sign of a shy, ill-equipped leader, one who perhaps is not the person who should lead us to freedom. So those are very lively moments when people have to engage the text or the story, but it's very active and we're watching it. The other thing I do is something called Speed Magid. The Magid, as you know, is the story. We are supposed to tell the story, which is essentially the Exodus yarn. It's often for people coming at a random time and they don't realize it's a section of the Haggadah that's kind of, you could almost pull out. Instead of reading it, I do a game called Speed Magid. There are two teams in the room. We usually have about 25, 30 people. So two teams, one representative comes forward. There's a little bell like from a game show. And I ask these questions that are just about the story. And people ring the bell if they feel like they know it. And their team can help them. It's kind of like a lifeline if you're struggling. And those questions are, you know, who pulled Moses from the water? Was it Pharaoh's daughter or Pharaoh's wife? That's one of those details a lot of people confuse. I think it's kind of a nice thing to know it. But it's often one that people get wrong. Then there's easier ones like who did Moses bring with him to speak for him because he said that he was tongue-tied. And some people know that it was his brother Aaron and some people don't. But it's a fun way, I think, to learn. And I do think the kids want to rise to participation. They don't want to be the ones who don't know. So from year to year, those questions stay with them and they're able to answer more each time. Those are two of them. I can go on, but they end up being very raucous and fun. Oh, there's one thing I will say. I hope everyone adds to their Seder. I did not invent it. I learned about it from David Wolpe, who's a rabbi in LA at Temple Sinai, or Sinai Temple, which has a large Persian congregation, predominantly Persian Jews. This ritual is that you have a scallion at your plate, and during Dayenu, the scallion becomes the whip of the slave masters, and you whip each other during the chorus, just with the chorus, or it gets too chaotic. But you can imagine how fun it is on both sides of you. You're whipping, you're being whipped. It's a scallion, so it doesn't actually hurt you, but it's one of those great moments of chaos in a Jewish family. That actually, I think, even though the song is fun anyway, people really look forward to the scallion flogging in my family now.
Of course, it's important for adults to have a great experience at the Seder. And actually, I think that it's important for adults to focus on themselves more than they do. But of course, it's also important, and really, it's in many ways one of the main goals of the Seder, according to Jewish tradition, that the children have a great experience. So Abigail Progerben had some ideas about how to make the children's experience great that are distinct from perhaps how to make the adult experience great.
To me, the kids' participation at the Seder is the most important part. And that means not just me coming up with, you know, fun games, but for them to prepare something to teach. And we did this early on, and they rose to it at a very young age. I think we started when they were 6, 7 years old. A 7-year-old can explain the Seder plate. A 7-year-old can explain the matzah. And then a 12-year-old can explain the four questions. I mean, dividing up, what I would do is email, here are the blocks, pick your block. You are responsible for just teaching the table, however you want to do it. You can write a rap, you can make a collage, you can do a PowerPoint, you can just speak. But what it did was it made each kid that was coming integral and essential to the Seder itself. It made the kids sit up, pay attention more to each other. And frankly, often what the kids researched, even the parents didn't know. So that's what I would just recommend more than anything, is that it shouldn't just be one leader teaching from on high or leading through the book, but something that engages everyone at the table because it's everyone's story.
We asked Abigail for some concluding thoughts on the Haggadah and on the Seder as she's experienced it and thought about it in writing her book.
I think the problem in some senses is that the alternative route is teachy and preachy, and that backfires too. So either we are, as a family, just kind of getting through the Haggadah, you know, hitting all the marks quickly and then getting to the meal, and we're so glad to be together. Or somebody's trying to kind of add depth and meaning, and it's kind of annoying and, you know, foisting some kind of seriousness and depth that feels forced. I've been in that situation without naming names. And it's, you kind of resist it and you kind of just wish you could go and eat the meal. So finding that balance of making it meaningful without making it medicine, I think is the sweet spot. But I think there's no better holiday to try. And certainly one of the things, forget about the Haggadah I put together, which I can send to anybody. I'm just so, you know, happy to share because I've crowdsourced my Haggadah from what I think are some of the best, most interesting things. But there is now the Make Your Own Haggadah, Haggadot.com. There are all these ways that you can kind of make these things your own by drawing on texts, poetry, songs that feel right for your family or your friends or your tradition. I mean, the only thing I would warn there is that sometimes it ends up being a hodgepodge and not, there's no sort of through line. And I think that this, just for me, I think it's nice to feel like there's an arc that ultimately gives you something to take away and isn't just a kind of a bunch of nice poems or ruminations, you know, that there's something ultimately that you're getting at that you come away and say, think differently about the holiday or about what it makes you want to do in your own life.
So I think that I'm reaching a kind of turning point in my personal thinking about the Seder and how to play around with it in terms of my own family. For a long time, I have been working on trying to reshape the Haggadah. You know, I'm starting to feel like maybe the Haggadah isn't where it's at, that somehow we've kind of confused the Haggadah for what the Haggadah is trying to accomplish. So I'll share some of my own Haggadah experiences, because I think that maybe it'll, maybe there are listeners who still are really interested in kind of thinking in different ways about the Haggadah. So, you know, I'm not really sure on a lot of levels if this is ultimately the way to go, but it was something that I was grappling with, trying to make sense of being Jewish and also trying to make sense of being American for me. And for the last few years, I've been working on trying to create a family Haggadah that kind of lines up the story of slavery in America and the story of slavery of the Israelites, and certain compares and contrasts that I provide for interesting conversation, such as looking at the Dayenu song where we say, well, if we had only gotten some of the things, half of the things, it would have been enough, right? We would have been grateful, contrasting that with Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech, where he talks about we'll never be satisfied until justice rolled down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. You know, the idea that really half a loaf is not sufficient, and really talking about those questions. As I think about it, though, one of the obvious other questions that arises, right, is that not all Jews are not African-American, and not all African-Americans are not Jews, and yet most Jews are not African-American, and most African-Americans are not Jews. And how do we think about trying to do a joint exploration of that story? And I know you work on these issues, so I was curious what you think about.
Yeah, I mean, it's important for our audience to keep in mind that about 20% of Jews aren't white Ashkenazi, meaning of Eastern European or European origin or white. They could be many different things. So there are Jews who are African American who have to think about that intersection between being Black and Jewish, and what does the American story teach us, and what does the Jewish story teach us, and how's that come together? And I think we're going to get to that when we have in our food episode the wonderful Michael Twitty talking about his own understanding of Passover. And in America, there is a long tradition of freedom seders, of seders that bring together the African-American experience of slavery and the biblical Jewish story. And for many African-Americans who are Christian, that those stories come together seamlessly because both those stories are part of their narrative. For white Jews, the American story of slavery is one that I think we struggle with trying to make sense of. And then when we come to Passover, Passover offers a particularly good opportunity to revisit the meaning of that story and for us to consider the impact of, you know, how does it play out for us as what if we are white, as I'm white, just to be clear, you can't see me, but I am white. And I benefit from people assuming that I'm white and people treating me like I'm white. And I also benefit from the social structures that were created and set in place by slavery. So even though I myself did not participate, I have to think about that legacy. And that's something that I struggle with each year at Passover. And actually, I struggle with it all year round in trying to think about what we do with that.
Yeah. And I guess that that comes back to something that, you know, again, I recognize that perhaps non-white Jews will not experience this element of what I'm talking about in the same way. But at least for me, the idea of talking about both slavery stories together really focuses me, at least, on the thing that I think is actually, in my opinion, probably most important for Jews, for sure white Jews, but I think probably for all Jews, to be focused on in terms of thinking about Passover in the times in which we live, that there's at least as much danger of us being the oppressor as the oppressed. And I think that sometimes studying, you know, the way that we do the Seder all the time in terms of just focusing on the wrong that was done to us as Jews or to our ancestors as Jews doesn't fully expose the danger that we ought to be worrying about in terms of repeating and reenacting the story every year, that how do we make sure that we don't become the Pharaoh or that we don't become the kind of silent majority of Egyptians, Americans that allowed these terrible things to happen and that have done so throughout history?
Dan, that's a great question, because I think it's something that I struggle with a lot and I think a lot about in terms of every group, even groups that are oppressed or not as empowered, have hierarchies within them. And I think that the potential for any of us to become masters over others is always there. And that's a danger. And coming on the heels of Purim, which is a Jewish holiday where we remind ourselves that the story, the narrative of victimization could be turned inside out, we go from there to Passover. And so in Passover, we really primarily focus on this victimization narrative. But I think that the remembering that all the pieces of the story, like coming on that, it could be inverted. We do have that potential for inversion. And I wonder, what would it be like if, and we buy clothing that's made by slave labor in places in Southeast Asia or in Mexico. We buy fruits and vegetables that aren't paid for with people's sweat and tears that we don't pay money for because they're practically slave labor costs. We do all of these things. What would it look like if in that week of Passover, we each decided that we would really pay attention to slavery as we see it around the world? What would it look like if for 1 week a year, I really tried, forget about the not eating bread, although I'm not going to eat bread, but really tried to only eat fair trade chocolate, to eat fair trade foods, organic, not because it's good for me, because it's good for the people who pick it. What would that look like? And I think that offers us a new way of thinking about it. I think your question is really pertinent to this time and this day and age. What would it look like if we did not assume that we, like if you went for 8 days and spent 2 hours every day for those 8 days of Passover working at a soup kitchen, feeding people who don't have food? Passover might have a different meaning for us, but I think it would have the meaning that we're meant to have, which is one of liberation, which is one of considering the power structures and the challenges of larger power structures that we don't necessarily feel that we have control over.
Yeah, so I think that in sort of wrapping up this discussion about the Seder, it seems to me that we're sort of coming around to putting the pieces together. And I'm excited about using food as another vehicle through which we can sort of put all the pieces together and experience it bodily. But I think the Seder is also a way of experiencing this bodily. I think actually that's some of the genius of the structure of Passover that we've received, right? This idea that we have a holiday, we want it to mean something. We've talked about what it might mean. We've got a technology of sort of reenacting this time in our history, whether real or mythic, where we experienced what we hope we will never experience again and what we hope we'll never allow others to experience again. And somehow by reenacting that experience, we are attuned, woken up, etc., to that in the world in which we live. And if there's nothing else that I kind of hope that I'll take away from these conversations over these weeks and others may take away from it, it's just that fundamentally the question is our experience of the Seder doing that? Is our experience of the 8 days of Passover doing that? And if not, what are some of the tweaks we could make to it to explore whether there's some modified way that we could do these things in which we would feel and experience that essence that we're trying to achieve? And that is a lot more important than going through the particular set of motions that we sort of have internalized are the things that you do for Passover, but not fully registering with that sense. At least that's how I kind of see it looking from this perspective. How about you?
Well, I think that the challenge that we're raising might be one that would be great conversation at your Seder, you know, to talk about that at your Seder, to ask friends and family, what are you going to do over the next 7 days to really embody liberation and embody the struggle towards freedom? And I think that I'm excited to listen and hear from our listeners what they think that the answers to that might be. I'm curious what my Seder guests this year are going to have to say on that issue. And I think that if we did that, I think we would be going far to fulfilling the mission of the Seder, which is to tell the story of going forth from Egypt and really feeling as though you yourselves were slaves in Egypt. If we can really embody that, then we're going to get there.
So thanks a lot for this conversation. We'll be back in the next episode talking about food, talking to some of the greatest chefs that are making Jewish food about how they're thinking about food today. And in conclusion, I just want to remind folks that this is an experimental podcast series where we're trying to experiment with ways to do deep dives into the Jewish holidays. This series has been probably about half or so as long as we hope that our series will ultimately be where we explore the Jewish holidays. We'd love to get your feedback and your thoughts and your ideas about how this podcast can best solve the needs that you're trying to solve in your Jewish life. And you can email me at dan@nextjewishfuture.org with any thoughts and ideas that you may have. You can also check out our website at www.judaismunbound.com, especially explore the resources section where there's some great material on the Jewish holidays. Passover site is going to launch very shortly. And you can also make a donation there at www.judaismunbound.com/donate. We really appreciate donations. We really need your donations in order to make this podcast what we really hope that it can be. We have said it before. We realize that we're going to have to do a lot more editing on this podcast than we do on Judaism Unbound in order to make it the kind of great exploration and have many voices like we want it to be. That's going to require more resources, and we really hope that folks out there are interested in helping us accomplish that. So Ruth, we'll be back again with our episode on food, which frankly we could only do with you as a co-host because I don't know anything about it. And I'm excited to see you back here again real soon. And with that, this has been Holidays Unbound.